Good morning, everyone. We are making our way through the beginning of Paul's letter to the church in Corinth. This is one of Paul's most complete letters that we have. Paul covers a lot of territory in this letter. Today, he's trying to express what is really not possible to express in words. That is the mystery of God, of the ways of God. For Paul, at the heart of the gospel is a mysterious wisdom. If you try to understand it logically, you'll be stumped. There is a mystical way of knowing that Paul has discovered, but he cannot express. Today, he tries. When I came to you, brothers and sisters, I did not come proclaiming the mystery of God to you in lofty words or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I came to you in weakness and in fear and much trembling. My speech and my proclamation were not with plausible words of wisdom, but with a demonstration of the Spirit and of the power, so that your faith might rest not on human wisdom, but on the power of God. Yet among the mature we do speak wisdom, though it is not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age, who are doomed to perish. But we speak God's wisdom, secret and hidden, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor human heart conceived, what God has prepared for us who love him. These things God revealed to us through the Spirit, for the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. For what human beings know, what is truly human, except the human spirit that is within. So also no one comprehends what is truly God's except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit that is from God, so that we may understand the gifts bestowed on us by God. Today our gospel reading continues our reading of the Sermon on the Mount from the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus has gathered his disciples, his closest friends around him, and he is teaching them. In Matthew's gospel, more than all other gospels, Jesus is portrayed as a wisdom teacher, like a new Moses. He is the giver of the new law. The Sermon on the Mount is the best example of the new teaching, and today he's trying to help his disciples understand their part in the gospel. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how can the saltiness be restored? Is no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Hear what the church is, hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Join me in prayer. May the words of my mouth, and the meditations of our hearts, and the actions of our lives be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. We become what we practice. Have you ever noticed how, on occasion, if you look at somebody who's been doing a particular career or a particular task for a long time, they start to actually look something like the task they're doing? Have you ever seen pictures, physical features start to kind of take on elements of the thing that they're doing? The airline pilot with the wind-blown hair. The secretary whose face even looks organized. Do you know? I was reminded of this week when I heard the story of the race car driver who had been driving for years and years and years, and finally he drove his last race and he retired, and so there was a lot of talk and the media got involved, and there was one reporter that was interviewing him, and he said, you know, it's been so many years, and that's a lot of time going really fast. Has it affected your body at all? And the guy said, no. Have you ever noticed that sometimes married people start to take on features of each other over the years, you know? And it's not just that they shop at the same place, but, you know, they actually, you probably have seen these, the pictures of people who look like their pets, you know, the wrinkle-faced dog with the wrinkled-faced man, the sculpted poodle on a leash held by a woman in a bouffant hairdo, it happens, Well, we're making our way through the fifth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, and a few weeks ago we read the Beatitudes, the blessings. Blessed are the most unlikely set of characters. In this sermon, Jesus lays out the core of the radical way that he is calling people to practice such that they start to look like it. Today, we hear him say those memorable words, "You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth." And each of these statements is not just like a one-liner to boost the troops, you know. This is not the coach talking to the Olympic team in the locker room before they head out there trying to just pump them up. He says, you are the light of the world, and as such, you are not to be people of shadow, but people of light, through whom the light of God, the light of grace and truth, the light of justice and peace shines, bends through you to create all the colors of the universe. You have a practical, real part to play in the giving of the light of God in this world. You do, he says. And I wonder what it would look like, what we would start to look like as a community of faith if we were to make a concerted effort to live each day as light on the corner of 156th and 88th, or on whatever other corner we're standing on, whatever other place in life we find ourselves. As salt of the earth, the ingredient in the community that gives it life, its flavor, preserves life as salt does. If that were our occupation, our preoccupation, I wonder what we would start to look like. If in everything we do, singing, studying the Bible, making dinners at the Hub, creating a beautiful place on this corner, in every interaction that we have with people who come through whatever door we're beside, in all of our relationships with our renters, when we open the thrift store every day, when we go and talk to someone living under a tarp, under a tree in the back 40, when we gather for coffee on Wednesday mornings, when we prepare budgets and negotiate with roofers, in every single interaction, if we were to think ahead and deliberately think about the actions that we are about to take, even the ones we're uncertain of, and say a little prayer that says, "May it reveal your light, O God." I wonder what that would look like if we were that deliberate about it. When we finally get to the place where we're making the decision about this property, I wonder what difference it would make for us and for this thing where we are, this community we are, if before we made a decision we were to think, well, whatever we choose here, whatever path we choose, whatever is created here, it needs to be a place of light. It needs to be a place that preserves the gift of life. It needs to be the spice of life. I wonder how that would change, may not change the outcome, but I wonder how it would change the way we decide stuff. A number of years ago, at a meeting of BC Conference, as there always is at a meeting of BC Conference, there's a service where we celebrate ministry, and particularly we lay hands on people who will be ordained. And I remember Barb Langton, a friend of mine from the Kootenays, she was speaking at the service, and she trotted out those old words that are very United Church, where we say to people who are ordained that you are set apart for ministry in the United Church. And she said, "I don't believe that. I don't believe in any setting apart." She said, "I want us to say, you are embedded for ministry. Embedded in the midst of a community. That's what it means to be in ministry. We are called to be embedded, to be so much a part of the community that we blend in like salt does in stew." In other words, called to be salt, like the marinade that becomes a part of the meat and it makes a tender difference. Well, if that were the case for me here, well, I'd first of all have to start calling myself Jim, because that seems to be the most common and, it's a good guess. If you run into a guy from Northwood, just call him Jim if you're not sure, and you have better odds than most. And maybe I should start knitting. Because, you know, these prayer shawls and stuff, although I don't think I'd blend in, I think it would be more like a prayer knot than a prayer shawl. But that's the task, is to be a part. Be in amongst, be, that's the task for all of us. For us as a community, as Northwood here on this corner of Surrey, is to be so connected with the community around us that we are it. Offering light and the flavor of life. I mean, Jesus said to his disciples, "You are called to be that which gives flavor. You have the power to preserve, to heal. You are a basic element in life. Embed yourselves in the world with that sacred power so that you make a difference to the life that God unfolds around you." That's quite a calling. William Sloan Coffin, one of the great preachers of the 20th century in the United States and pastor of Riverside Church in New York City, was asked once what he felt was the most significant sin of the North American church. And his answer? Complacency. He's saying that our biggest sin as a church, as a Christian church, is complacency. It's really interesting because I think if he were to be asked what the most significant sin of North America is, he'd probably have said greed. Because that one just kind of jumps out at you. But he didn't say that of the church. It's not that we have too much. It's that we are doing too little with it. While there is suffering in the world, while there is prejudice, while there is dreadful poverty, he said, our biggest sin is that we just sit there. With all this salt and all this light, in a typical, and he's American, right? So in typical understated Canadian ways, we see, we think, who are we to share the light? Because we're just little and insignificant in our self-deprecating ways. And yet we don't realize, what we don't realize is that we're actually by doing that, we're actually diminishing the significance of the gospel light that has been given to us. I think in the Canadian church, it's actually a self-esteem issue. Jesus says, you are light, and we see, well, not us, not really light. Maybe pale fabric, let's go with that. But light? That's far too out there for us. We're much more background people, filler maybe, but not light. Not foreground. And we believe Jesus, and I guess I believe Jesus' response would be no, no, no. Light. The world needs you to get past your self-deprecating diminishment of God's gifts that God has made and placed in you and shine. It's just like that oft-quoted Marianne Williamson quote, I'm sure you've heard it. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. So maybe it's not a self-esteem thing. Maybe it's a fear thing. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. You are all meant to shine, as children do. You are born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And we let our own light and as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. And we are liberated from our fear. Our presence automatically liberates others. You are the light of the world. This does not mean you need to be Jesus. You need to be some great hero of the faith, some Olympian caliber Christian. No. No, that's to put a competitive measure on it. No, you are called to be light, and that light is you. We were talking at the book club this week about this. I believe that When Jesus said, "You are the light of the world," he was not, he was calling people to be themselves, fully themselves, so that there is one Will Sparks in this world, and I can try to be just like somebody else that I admire, but I would be less Will Sparks if I did that. That would be to diminish the light of God in me. What I need to do is figure out who am I and be that. Be that fully. And we know this. We know this because we see it in other people. We know that when we see Nathan, and Nathan's trying to be somebody else, we think, oh, geez, I wonder why he's doing that. But when Nathan kind of steps into his own skin and loves the things he loves and does them with a whole heart, we think, wow, a blaze of light right there. It doesn't have to be loud. It doesn't have to be brash. It just has to be authentic. And when it is authentic, when we are being the people we're called to be, the people God has made us to be, when we have the self-awareness to say, this is me and I'm going to be it, that's divine light shining through. You are the light of the world. You, being you, us, being authentically us. And so we practice. And as we practice, we start to get glimmers. The ember starts to shine and the Spirit blows on that ember. And we become the light of the world.